morning.
Good morning.
So I'm from the Health Policy Institute of Ohio. Do we have anyone from Ohio here today? No? How about the Midwest? All right. All right, so I'm going to talk about our experiences with identifying a set of metrics for measuring health value in Ohio, and we call this our Health Measurement Initiative. And the product of this work is going to be a health value dashboard that we're going to be releasing in December. So this is very much a work in progress. We are learning as we go. So maybe I can come back next year and share with you how it all shakes out. But the slide that you had with the monster and the chaos, we're still kind of there to some extent. But I can certainly share with you some of our lessons learned so far. So the theme of this session is collective impact, and I have the same confession that Michael had, which is that we weren't initially thinking of this work as collective impact, but actually as we've learned more about the concept of collective impact, we realize that it's actually a really good example of collective impact. So these are the five success conditions for collective impact. This comes from a piece that was in the Stanford Review a few years ago. We didn't make this up. And I'm going to talk today about three of these components. So the backbone organization piece, which Michael talked about as well, having a common agenda and shared measurement. So a little bit about our organization. We are a statewide organization. Policymakers are our primary audience, so that means our state legislators and state agency leadership for the most part. We are nonpartisan and independent, so neutral convening is a really natural role for us, and you had asked about funding. We're primarily funded by private foundations for the most part. So being a backbone organization is a really natural fit for us. So these are some of the organizations that are part of our Health Measurement Advisory Group, and then we serve as the backbone for pulling these folks together to do this work. And we are a really small organization. We have 7 staff, so we really have to work collaboratively with others to get things done. And we also need to get along with Republicans and Democrats. We need to get along with public health and with health care. And within public health, we need to get along with local public health and state public health. And within health care, we need to get along with providers and purchasers and payers and consumers. So that is not always easy, but I think it's fruitful. All right, so the second component here for collective impact is having a common agenda. And for us, that common agenda is improving health value, and we've defined that as improving population health outcomes and alongside having sustainable health care costs. And we've found that this idea of health value really resonates with all of these different stakeholders that we're bringing together and has been a really good way to bridge healthcare and public health folks, and as well as policymakers, because they're certainly very concerned about health value. So how are we doing? Not very well. So in Ohio, we really typify this problem, you know, that the U.S. has overall of having very high healthcare costs, but having pretty poor health outcomes. So Ohio tends to rank towards the bottom when you look at state rankings of health outcomes. So in the low 30s or the high 30s or low 40s. So we wanted to come up with a conceptual framework that would help us to explain why we're doing poorly in health value, what is health value, what contributes to health value. So in doing that, we look to many of the great models that are out there, population health models, like the county health rankings model that folks are probably very familiar with. We also look to America's health rankings and other rankings that are out there, like the Commonwealth State Scorecard and the RWJ Data Hub. And those are all really helpful tools and really important models for helping to explain why population health is good or bad. But there's kind of a critical piece that's missing from these models. Anybody have any thoughts on what it might be. Yeah, cost, yes. Exactly. So we also wanted to reference the triple aim, which does explicitly include cost in its model. So we developed a conceptual framework, and this really came out of our advisory group. We worked with that group to develop this framework, which is kind of a mashup of the triple aim with population health models like county health rankings. And so our endpoint is improving health value. And then we have these other domains on the left, which are the systems and environments that impact health value. We might refer to these as the determinants of health. And it's really important to us, particularly because we're working with policymakers and with healthcare system folks, it's really important to us to include the physical environment and the social and economic environment and really emphasize that we can't just focus on healthcare system performance and access. And certainly in the policy world, in the state policy world, in Ohio, and I think probably in most other places, most of the action has been around access and around healthcare, to some extent, quality and payment reform. And we wanna broaden that view a little bit. All right, so the third component for collective impact that I'm going to talk about is shared measurement. And this is really the heart and soul of this project. So we put out an initial dashboard back in 2013 that just included a few population health outcomes and some cost indicators. That was just kind of our starting place. And then what we've been doing over the past year is working with that broad group of stakeholders to build out a more comprehensive dashboard that includes those other domains, the determinant domains as well. All right, so I'm going to go quickly through these. All right, so there are lots of dashboards out there, right? Lots of state rankings. But we look to those first to see if they could do what we wanted to do. And none of them really included all of the domains that we wanted to focus on. So we are creating our own dashboard building on these. So what will make our dashboard different is that we have a much stronger focus on cost and that endpoint of value. We are including the more upstream determinants as well. So again, emphasizing that it's not just healthcare system and access, to kind of shift that conversation beyond the doctor's office. And then the third piece is that what we're creating is very much an at-a-glance, short publication that is for a policymaker audience. So it's not an interactive online kind of thing. We're going to sort of point people to County Health Rankings, RWJ Data Hub, other sources where they can drill down. Legislators do not take the time typically to sit and click, right, to drill down in data. We need something short and colorful that can prompt a broader conversation about, we're not doing very well on health value. Ooh, we're not doing very well on tobacco. Why is that? And then have a conversation about why and what we can do about it. So I'll talk a little bit about the process that we've gone through to develop this dashboard and to pull our metrics. So we have work groups that assigned to each of these domains, and each work group had about 8 to 12 people in it and included folks who have been with us from the beginning in developing the conceptual framework, and then we also recruited some additional folks to make sure we had the expertise that we needed to select our metrics. And we started with the list of metrics from those other scorecards and rankings that I mentioned, Commonwealth and America's Health Rankings. We started there and then invited our work group members to bring additional metrics to the table that we maybe weren't aware of. And we had each work group, we had one staff person assigned, so myself or my colleague Reen Alley, who's not here today. And then we had a co-chair for each work group who was somebody outside of HPIO. And we worked, our work group members worked really hard. We made them actually do work for us and worked pretty well. So we had a set of criteria that we used for prioritizing the metrics, and I won't go into detail on these unless you have questions at the end, but we use these criteria to kind of help us narrow down the list of metrics, which in some of the domains was really, really difficult. So healthcare system performance, there are, you know, a bajillion metrics out there. That was a very difficult one. Public health, that domain was actually extremely challenging. There were not very many metrics where we had state-level data for all states. All right, so the results of that process was that we have a list of about 100 metrics, so about 15 per domain. And there's a list of these metrics. If you're interested in seeing what they actually are, it's on our. There's a link in my last slide. But if you go to the Health Policy Institute of Ohio website and search health measurement, it'll come up. There's a publication that has all of these listed out. Although we have made a few substitutions and revisions. But for the most part, it's there. So what we're doing now is working on our layout and messaging. We contracted with the University of Cincinnati Economic Center to actually compile the data. So we're kind of in the final stages of cleaning up the data and starting to lay it out. And this is just kind of a mock-up of one of the pieces of the dashboard. We'll have kind of one-page pieces on each domain. So this is the population health domain. And then we'll also have a one-page high-level roll-up that shows the overall rankings for each domain and for the subdomains to give that really quick picture of how we're doing. So, and we have a work group on layout and messaging as well to make sure that we're getting lots of input, and we'll shop it around with some legislators to make sure it's resonating with them. All right, so a few months ago, we were able to kind of supercharge our health measurement initiative thanks to a grant from NNPHI that's focused on bridging public health and health care. So these are the goals of that project. And one of the requirements for that project was to have a conceptual framework. And that was easy for us because we already had our conceptual framework, which is our pathway to health value diagram. And that conceptual framework really came out of healthcare and public health folks talking together. So it was a really good fit for this project. And then the added pieces that we're doing really as a result of the grant is that we are identifying some areas for statewide collective impact based on the results of the dashboard. So on December 16th, we're going to be releasing the dashboard, and then the following day, we're having a workshop for a smaller group of folks to really look at the results of the dashboard and identify some priorities for us to explore to do future work on in 2015. And oh, the other piece that we're working on is we have a work group to come to consensus on a definition of population health. So bringing together healthcare and public health folks to do that. And this is something that I guess has eluded many, and we have found it to be a challenge as well. So these are, you know, different groups that have been sort of working on coming up with this consensus definition. And I think the challenge is really not so much the definition itself, but you know, there's sort of all this stuff that we want to put in the definition, yet we want to keep it concise. And really what we need is a definition that's actionable and operationalized. That's really what folks seem to be sort of crying out for. So we will have a definition, but we also came up with these key characteristics of population health strategies to dig a little deeper. Almost like a checklist to sort of see, because folks in healthcare are often sort of wondering, well, are we doing population health? Does this count as population health? And this is a way to kind of talk through, you know, population health strategies are beyond the patient population, beyond medical care, they measure outcomes, they're focused on equity, closing gaps, and there's some shared accountability. And so we'll be putting out a publication soon that lays these out and provides some examples of each of these and ways that this is different from healthcare business as usual. And this really comes out of the conversations that we've had with that group, which have been really interesting, but sometimes painful. All right. So, and this is just a slide about the event that we're having in December, where we'll release the dashboard. So, putting a focus on shared accountability and health value. All right. So, some lessons learned. So, a really important thing for us with this initiative, but in other collaborative work that we do, is really defining the problem that you're trying to solve up front. And we have some guiding questions for that that have been really helpful. So what is the problem we're trying to solve, and what will be different if we are successful? So we find if we start with those questions, that can help us to build a conceptual framework or a logic model to get us going in the right direction. The second lesson here is to invite lots of stakeholders. We have a really big group, but to give them meaningful work to do. So in our metric selection work groups, for example, we gave folks homework. You know, we assigned them a set of metrics or a subdomain and said, you're responsible for this subdomain for, you know, checking the quality of the data, the availability of the data, and bringing that to the group. And not everybody did their homework, but many people did, and I think those who did that are much more engaged and invested in the process. So, you know, they don't just have to show up for meetings, but really need to think through things and contribute in a significant way. The third is to continually remind stakeholders of the purpose of the work and the progress that's been made. So, you know, we start the meetings with kind of the same set of slides, reminding about the conceptual framework and what we're trying to accomplish, because we always have, you know, there's always turnover and it's never the same group necessarily in the room, so we need to keep doing that reminding. And similarly, helping participants to visualize the endpoint. So we would often talk about, you know, the goal here is to have a very at-a-glance visual dashboard that we can sit down with a legislator and prompt a conversation. So kind of have that image in your mind as we're doing the work. The fifth is to continually acknowledge that you're building on existing work and aligning and not duplicating. So this is, you know, this is tricky, right? Because there are lots of things going on and there are lots of rankings and dashboards that are already out there. So we're always talking about how we're building on County Health Rankings and America's Health Rankings and the other scorecards that are out there. And that we're, you know, always trying to align with other things that are going on in the state. So the State Health Improvement Plan, we've tried to select metrics that are also in that. We're also coordinating with our State Innovation Model initiative in Ohio. So, and then we have lots of regional activity going on in Ohio as well. So we're always, you know, trying to align with those things and at least talking about them. So that folks are aware of those as well. The sixth is just time. I mean, it's very time consuming to do this kind of work. And the last one, this came from my boss, don't let perfection stand in the way of progress. This is sort of her mantra. If we, you know, waited for the perfect set of metrics for a dashboard, we would never have a dashboard because, you know, some of the data that we wish we had just does not exist yet. And so we just need to kind of accept that and move forward with what we have, and I think it'll be meaningful. All right. So this is the link to the website with the list of metrics if folks are interested in that.
Wonderful. Thank you. So thank you, and congratulations to both of you and your institutes for this work. And I love the elephant. I might want to ask you if we could borrow that sometime.
Well, it comes from IOM.
Yeah.
Okay. So we didn't create
it. No, but you embellished it. Yeah.
We did. We embellished the element, and we start our meetings with that.
Yeah, well, that's great. So. So we promise we leave time for questions and dialogue. I certainly have questions, but I want to see what people, reactions, questions you all have, please. Steve.
I wanted to ask a little bit. I don't know about how many others in the room are from academic institutions, but you certainly are. So at our academic institution, we have been very much into the community and have worked very hard at CDPR and community engagement and the work that we are proposing to doing under collective impact is building on that. But we're trying to reorganize ourselves around the community backbone model. As I mentioned earlier when I called on you that we're thinking of IPHI functioning as the backbone organization in Richmond as well. But are struggling with how to think of ourselves as the so-called anchor institution, the term that's often used about where the academic university fits in. And in your example in Ohio, at the tail end you mentioned the University of Cincinnati stepping in and helping with the data analysis. Can both of you say a bit more about where a school of public health or an academic institution fits in as a think tank or research arm for a community-based initiative of collecting impact? Especially one that already has its tentacles in the community and is engaged in the community.
Well, I think academic institutions are essential partners, for sure. And in some cases, they may be the backbone. I mean, it doesn't need to only be one. There will be lots of efforts where we have, a collective approach. One thing to consider, what resources does an organization or entity have to bring? What are they best at? How do they operate? Does that lend itself to what the goals of the approach are? And so if we have, certain types of projects, universities might be the appropriate backbone. In other cases,
Other questions?
I'd just also say that it really depends on the community and its resources. I'm in Baltimore City. The last executive of the line should be really helpful. You know, so, but in other communities, you know, they're in the area where they are in the area of the hospital. And you're listening or in the hospital. And you haven't been to some region to be there and you haven't seen other bad people themselves.
I wanted to ask you to go back to the slide because I'm still not sure I understand.
Sure.
When we talk about health value, mm-hmm. we bring this around cost. But I'm not exactly sure what do you see when you look to speak to the health value? Do you see a number? Do you see a ranking? Do you see a dollar?
So we have ranked Ohio on like overall healthcare expenditure growth. Per member costs in Medicare and Medicaid, out-of-pocket costs for consumers, costs for employers and employees. But what we're really trying to say with this is that, obviously we need to improve health outcomes. But the goal is not just to improve health outcomes at any cost. The goal is to do it in a way that the costs are sustainable, so it's not crowding out everything else. And so we're really, want to become a state that's healthy and sustainable. So, some of our states, like, Massachusetts is a great example of a state that's very healthy, does very well on state rankings and health outcomes. They also have very high costs. So our goal is not necessarily to be Massachusetts. Our goal is to be more like some other high-value states. Actually, California does pretty well in terms of much lower costs than we have and better health outcomes. So that's where we're trying to head.
So it's a concept, not a concrete measure.
Right. So we're ranking how Ohio does on the cost measures and ranking how Ohio does on the health. And we actually have like a Venn diagram thing where we have like the bottom quartile of states in terms of health outcomes, and the bottom quartile states in terms of costs, meaning have the highest costs. When we do that Venn diagram with preliminary data, Ohio is actually the only state in the middle. So we have a problem with that.
So when you make reference to legislators looking at this, they would be looking to see those two aspects.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So what we're saying is we want to see improvement in both of those areas.
Question in the back, yeah.
Going back to the role of the Health Institute in that being the bridging backbone, can you talk a little bit about what makes a public health institute particularly well poised to serve in that role? I mean, I understand there's probably distinctions, institute by institute, et cetera, versus another type of organization that would be and have some competencies in both areas. And is there anything happening from your national organization to sort of diffuse that into the local?
Well, sure. Actually, we've got several folks in the room that I would love to help contribute. There's a couple of staff here, too. Aaron and Chris are with us. And I know, Aaron, you're doing a lot of work on the bridging work in terms of this actual grant mechanism. A lot of the institutes around the country have very deep standing relationships with community folks, community organization systems, and then you heard, of course, from Amy about how they work with their state legislatures. One of the strengths of the institutes is that they're all sort of uniquely serving whatever population service area that they have defined, so the partnerships are there. Some of them are more state legislative focused, and some of them are more sort of programmatic focused, and so there's not a one-size-fits-all or a one answer to your question. It's a great question. I do think nationally what we are doing is to try to promote more of these types of programs. We give out about close to 60-65% on any given year of our revenues to do these types of joint projects, and part of the strength of that is not only, of course, at APHA, but we have an annual meeting where we bring together folks so they can share, you know, what's being learned, and so that those capacities are shared around the country. And there are lots of backbone potential organizations that may not be part of our network, but they might be isolated and not necessarily sharing and bringing it back to the communities. And so I think that's another strength that the network does provide. But I'll stop there. I don't know if Michael, Amy, you have anything to add, or even Chris and Aaron.
Yeah, I think if you look at the history of the development of public health institutes in this country, certainly there are some that are much older, Public Health Institute in California, Public Health System Solutions in New York City. But there was a surge in development of institutes over the last 15 years, and some of that work came out of an initiative called Turning Point, Collaborating for a New Century in Public Health, which Benny and I worked on, which was a joint effort of Kellogg Foundation and RWJ to look at the modernization of the public health system. But I think overall, the purpose of Turning Point was indicative of a need, and that is that there's a need to reshape the way that we do the work that we do, because the siloed approach, the government here, community there, these different sectors that all have roles to play in health, but they're, it's just all very fragmented. You need an infrastructure for that. And public health institutes have been seen kind of as a way to be a public-private, multi-sectoral body that works at a systems level with agility that government doesn't have. So when we developed our institute in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, it was really with that in mind. And so I think when you think about the role that a backbone plays, you want them to be multi-sectoral, you want them to have relationships with the different sectors that come to the table, operating at systems level, on policy, on workforce development, on systems integration, spurring and pushing innovation. So it seems like a pretty good fit. But again, there's, a wide range of collective impact efforts, and some of them will be more targeted focused, some of them may be more research-based, some of them may be more policy-focused, and depending on what the institute in your area is focused on, there may be other entities that also could be good backbones, but you do need to pay attention to groups' interests and what they can contribute. And, the backbone role sounds it's the central role, and you want to be that because they're the leader. But in some cases, it's really the underpinning that's sort of invisible, and the credit goes to some of the partners. So I don't think that it's always the case that you want to be the backbone. You may really want to be the partner because they get to do the work. So that's all.
Yeah, you don't want to be that.
Yeah.
Chris. I'm Chris Nimmer from Anthony Thomas. Half of our member survey, the leadership of the institutes, you might expect MPH or MD might be kind of the credential for the majority of the CEOs, but it's actually like MSW. So, and looking at the kind of competencies of the staff, you see a lot of these great facilitation skills. But it is, as speakers are acknowledging, there's being neutral, and then I think it's easy to be neutral in an early phase of your development unless you have some established programs and people think, maybe members or other people think of you in one capacity. It's hard to be neutral, but I think that's something we have active discussions about in our networks, whether you can still remain neutral on a particular initiative if you have a large program in another area.
I saw a hand here, and then over here.
So I think part of the thought of who should be the backbone is an issue of money. And there are entities that want to see this happen, but don't have the funding to do it, and I believe that potentially, if you're doing so, you can have this fund. Well, Maryland has, at the moment, standardized the concept. Not in terms of how it's applied in other jurisdictions, but essentially
have private foundations that provide core operating support to carry out our mission. So that gives us a lot of flexibility. It also, I think, gives us some neutrality because the foundations are not necessarily seen as having a particular perspective compared to some other sources of funding. And so we're very fortunate to have that base of support that basically pays for the staff to pull these things together. We're always seeking additional funding so that we can do even more, but we have that kind of base so that we have the staff and the, you know, the stuff that you need for convening multi-stakeholder groups, like a conference room and, you know, there's certain infrastructure kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a critical issue, and I think there's going to be opportunities for investment that either come along or that you create. So like in D.C., we saw the opportunity to bring together a myriad of partners to develop just a couple of shared goals across community development, food systems, primary care, population health, a lot of disparate areas of work with no funding whatsoever. And IPHI has been convening folks, and we've sort of been figuring out what is it that we should be doing together to create that agenda. And maybe it'll be funded at some point, maybe it won't. In other cases, we've, like in Montgomery County, we were asked to help with the Montgomery County Department of Health and Human Services to staff the Healthy Montgomery process. So we're sharing that backbone function with the Department of Health and Human Services. And the hospitals have funded that, realizing they need a backbone structure for a shared community health improvement planning process. But it is an issue because I think it's just recognizing that the system needs this different infrastructure and it needs core capacity, it needs to be supported. And there are a few funders in our region that understand that and are beginning to give us general operating support to serve in that role. But I think some of it's going to be just in the way that we've always had to fund our work. It's never been ideal or sustainable through, you know, these grant mechanisms and things.
Yeah, and the funding piece, I will add, I know the Archie group, Georgia Health Policy Center is another one of our institutes, and they're in Atlanta, and they have a regional collaborative called Archie, and it's funded. Essentially, they brought together folks that were doing a lot of the work and already funded on a variety of different community health improvement initiatives. Some of it is hospital-based, and some of it is, you know, federal grants. Some of it is, you know, county grants. And so they found the folks that were already sort of doing the work separately and brought them together over time. And I don't know what the timeline is on Archie, how many years they've been together. It's relatively new, not brand new. And so now they've got that momentum, and once, it's not so much they asked for the grant to start it, right, but now they've got money, you know, coming in, and more, a lot of the funders are sort of interested, hey, what are those folks doing in collective impact? So that might be a really, I don't know where you are, but that might be a really good way to, you know, bring folks that already have funding together. Steve.
So on that, that's a good segue to my question, because yesterday there was a session that was built around the federal reserve stuff that's been done. So there you have investment organizations and others. The examples that were presented at yesterday's session of collective impact initiatives and other communities that we have discussed today, where Goldman Sachs, the Federal Reserve, other investors have created social impact bond mechanisms where collective impact initiatives have, you know, I think they say saved $30 million. That was
It's a great question, and I'd love to hear Michael and Amy's thoughts. That's on our radar screen. I don't know that we have a strategy in place, but after APHA, we certainly will be working on that strategy. We might need another elephant on the slide, but I'd invite your reactions to that. I would also love to see us do a national webinar on this. We do a lot of national webinars, and when they're taped, then people could use them at other times.
Well, yeah, we're thinking of like Steve by going to the SoCap conference, the Social Capital Markets conference, and trying to begin to think about how we could get different sources of support for our work. And I talked with Doug in D.C. last week about the Regional Federal Reserve Office that serves both Maryland as well as Virginia and a couple of other jurisdictions, because the first, you know, they've had those forums around the country. The first one that was in our region was really more national focused. And there is someone at the Federal Reserve for our region that is, you know, potentially open to partnering. So I think we have an opportunity there to start that conversation. One of the things I've tried to share with folks when they work with IPHIs is to help them understand that we have now 43 institutes, 42 other institutes behind us that we draw on all the time. So there's this tremendous amount of, much more experience and capacity than we have at IPHI, but we engage them all the time in informing our work, and even through partner arrangements, we've talked about using them as extensions of our staff. So I think there's some opportunities there to help the regions that are served by institutes understand that there is this national network that, because they have an institute, they can bring those resources into their community through the institute. So that's what many of you refer to as
like a distributed capacity.
Right, distributed capacity.
And we just had our Federal Reserve conference a few weeks ago. Actually, the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland hosted a conference in Columbus that we were a part of, where Nate Berenson and Joe Stuve and Ian Galloway were speakers, and it was great. And we're sort of now in the phase of trying to figure out now what do we do with all of these great ideas. And I think we need help with that. And so if there was some kind of group of, because I know other public health institutes have been involved in their Federal Reserve regional conferences, and we can certainly use some ideas of help with what's the next.
We also, for the conference that we have in May, which will be back in the city and it'll be warmer than today, we also have an opportunity. The NMPHI conference is open to everyone, so it's not just the institutes, and so including the submission of abstracts. And so I don't know when the abstract should be coming out soon, right?
Right.
Early December. So if you want to be on that list after the session, just give us your business card, and we'll make sure that you are on that list. Any other comments, questions? Yeah.
Hey, Michael, I just have a quick question about more of a workforce lens and maybe thinking through like HRSA and other federal agencies. You know, there was I live here and I'm listening to NPR on the way in. And it's a great piece about predictions about the nation's needs for primary care physicians and integrated more into the Ronald Graham Center and health economists, but they only mentioned pharmacists and nurses as other providers, and there was no mention of community health workers. And just in a big picture way of thinking, I know you mentioned like APA, kind of warming up to the concept of community health workers, but in terms of federal investment and kind of workforce training, I mean, you all seem like you kind of just cobbled all this together and done it really well, but it's not like you got a grant to train community health workers or a, like where is the
No, it's an excellent question. I think that it's coming up in the individual states that are working on this process of professionalizing or formalizing the profession and kind of developing a credentialing system and these training standards. So once that's in place, who's going to do the training? And community health workers can't afford, they might be able to put a little skin in the game $500 or something, but in general, the community members we work with, I mean, they're generally not employed when they come into the program, and so the whole reason that we want them is because they're close to the community we're trying to serve. So there needs to be a funded capacity to train the workforce, and so I think each of the states are going to have to grapple with that, and it would be, I think, a tremendous show of leadership if some of the federal agencies, you know, put out some funding to develop community-based workforce development training institutes of some sort. And it's not just training community health workers. I mean, there are other types of workers that are close to the ground that I think we need to bring into the workforce in a more, you know, more formal and thoughtful way. So,
sir, you had a question?
Comment and question. Yes. So there's an economies of scale opportunity. I'm a potential customer today. There's presently a contract with the Mississippi Public Health Institute, which I think is a member.
Correct. Yep.
And they do independent evaluation of our SWHIV program in Mississippi. And then we put an FOA out to solicit an organization to develop a community health worker model for us. And things aren't going that well. I mean, they're going well with the Public Health Institute. So if you think about economies of scale, there's actually opportunities for institutes and states to proactively reach programs like ours. But the question is directed to Michael. So from the sustainability, and I just begin your presentation, Mississippi Medicaid covers women and children. And so the young Black African-American male in Mississippi is not covered. And so from a sustainability aspect, you have eligibility issues in D.C. if you cover males over the age of 20?
Yeah, I mean, every Medicaid plan is a bit different, and there are states that have opted out of the expansion. So, you know, I'm not an expert on the differences of Medicaid. D.C. is very progressive, and so we found, you know, a pretty ripe environment. But in Virginia, where they haven't yet expanded, we also found a lot of interest from the health department and even the Medicaid office in the strategy, because we frame it as being a way to use to get better health outcomes at lower costs and to help everybody operate at the top of their class or at the top of their profession. Unless I'm not sure that I'm able to respond to, you know, the differences between Mississippi Medicaid and D.C. I'll just say that there are definitely some policy environments that are less helpful, but we see opportunities. We've worked in a few of those environments and still see an opportunity, but I don't know if that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would require expansion for us to, for a community health worker to be reimbursed through Medicaid for working, say, with a 23-year-old, because they're not eligible right now. They have to have a disability, but basically they have to have AIDS. So that's kind of one challenge. So just as an aside, we use Ryan Light and HIV prevention funds to support that model.
Well, states that the disability requirement has effectively been eliminated from Medicaid?
I'm not sure if Mississippi, the agency hasn't changed.
Yeah, you probably have partnerships with your community health centers through funded through HRSA, and so that might be a good place to. Yeah, in terms of a collective impact model, because for the states, I mean, I live in Virginia, you know, we didn't expand, but the community health centers are picking up a lot of that sort of safety net slack, and now that we're working more with HRSA on the public health training centers, I'm hearing more about what they're doing with their community health center models are not just about care. They're trying to adopt a public health, population health model, so it might be a good starting place, even though it would be nice if you expanded, you know, Medicare. Other questions? I had a question that for either one of you or both of you about sort of incentives and also power dynamics when you're serving in these roles. Any lessons learned about you know, incentives that might work. So, because we've heard a lot of questions about, you know, how do you fund this stuff? And then there's probably some power issues going on about who's controlling the, you know, the backbone sort of structure or the work.
I think that probably the trickiest thing for us has been negotiating relationships with our the Ohio Department of Health and then the Governor's Office of Health Transformation, which is running our SIM, so State Innovation Model from CMS project. And those two state entities do not always get along. And there's some challenges in that, and we need to be aligning and friends with both of those entities. And we've had enormous turnover in our state health agency. We had the director of health has been a part of our health measurement initiative, but we've been through three different directors of health over the course of the project so far. And so when there's a new one, we sit down with them and bring them on board, but it's really hard to maintain that engagement with the leadership when the leadership keeps changing. And there's just, state politics, state agency politics involved there. And so that's, it's a continual balancing act. Ask me in a year from now.
Okay.
I'll
ask you in May.
Yeah, it is a process. I just think you have to just focus on the relationships. I think when I think when collaborative work happens, people begin to pay attention, and they want to. I think they value the force that's making that happen because it doesn't happen enough. And I think we've had some challenges with a few of the health departments in the region feeling a little bit threatened, but I think when they've seen that we can bring everybody to the table and get things done, they that's been of great value to them. We've also worked hard at kind of behind the scenes with the health departments and with the big associations to just be really useful in small ways to them, and they've seen that we've got their back. And so you build that trust. I think like anything else in business, it's trust and relationships, and over time those will pay off for you.
Good. Well, let's thank our speakers one more time. And if you want to...